We got a game seven, folks. We're breaking down game six. Me and Tom Haverstraw talking about some of the implications felt league-wide from this series as well. We're talking draft, Ace Bailey stuff going on, Cooper Flag, talking NBA rumors, KD, Paul George. That's all coming up right now. Game seven! We got a game seven. Pacers blow out the Thunder and to discuss it, Tom Haverstraw. What's up, Tom?
Oh my God. Game seven, best two words in sports, baby.
Dude, unbelievable that we're here. It's only the fourth time in the last 30 years we get a game seven. 2005 Spurs Pistons, 2010 Lakers Celtics, 2013 Heat Spurs. And then the last time was 9 years ago, Cavs 3-1 comeback against the Warriors in 2016. Hard to believe it's been that long since we had a game seven. And yet here we are on a night. I thought the Thunder might be the team blowing out the Pacers in the second quarter. And yet the Pacers are up 20 in the first half with Pascal Siakam, massive dunk at the end of the second quarter. Dude, I can't believe it, Tom. I just can't believe it.
What an unbelievable performance. Down 10-1 in the opening minutes of the game, can't hit a shot, and then proceeds the next 30 minutes of basketball as some of the most perfect basketball you will ever see. I mean, the passing, the defense, just everything that they were doing offensively to move the ball, get open shots, and then shut down Shai Gilgeous-Alexander and the Oklahoma City offense to 81 points every 100 possessions. Their offensive rating, Oklahoma City, a team that won 68 games and was on the verge of winning their first championship as Oklahoma City, and they get blown out. Kev, this is the most Cinderella postseason. Win game seven or not, the Indiana Pacers, what they're doing to force a game seven against OKC. Like, this is insane what we're watching right now.
It's just hard to believe how they keep doing it. Like I said earlier in the week on my pod with S. Barahini, I said this would be the best comeback out of all of them. I mean, obviously they had some just crazy single game fourth quarter comebacks. Those are their own category. But if you come back from down 3-2, and if you win the series with Halliburton dealing with an injury that supposedly is supposed to be a multi-week injury, if you have this comeback to top off this entire postseason that you've had, like this has been one of the better postseasons as a whole, but this Pacers run, like, when's the last time we saw like something at this level? I mean, we've seen teams like make runs, but not in the way that they've done it. It's just hard to fathom that they extended this series, but this is who they are. This is what they do.
Plus 5,000, the Indiana Pacers were underdogs of underdogs going into this year. And they keep doing this no matter who it is. You count them out and they will come back from the dead. They are the Undertaker in the coffin, sitting up, and the crowd goes nuts. The Indiana Pacers, like the passing, there was a play, I think it was in the second quarter, where they stole the ball and the ball didn't touch the ground once, and they passed it five times to get the open shot. And it was like, this is the stuff that coaches dream of. The Indiana Pacers play almost perfect team basketball. They move the rock. They do not turn the ball over. The Thunder did not steal the ball, Kev, until 6 minutes and 29 seconds left in the third quarter. Isaiah Hartenstein picked off a pass by Tyrese Halliburton. That was the first steal by the Oklahoma City defense that this entire season has been stealing the ball at extreme rates. This is their brand of basketball, the Thunder. They always turn over their opponent, and the Pacers went the entire first half without a live ball turnover. Just insane level of performance from the Indiana Pacers. Rick Carlisle, Tyrese Halliburton, dude, I want whoever doctor worked on Tyrese Halliburton's calf strain, I want to sign him up. I will blank check. If that dude had a calf strain in this game and it looks like that, that doctor is a miracle worker, man.
Dude, he looked normal. Like, if you didn't know about the injury, if you just tuned into the game and like you're not on social media or anything like that, you're just a casual fan, you'd think it's just normal. Like, there's nothing wrong with Tyrese Haliburton, the speed in which he was moving. He missed some shots early in the game, but, and the, you know, Indiana didn't have him bring the ball up the floor as much as they usually do either. So I think they were using him a bit as a decoy, but the movement was fine. He hit some great jumpers off the dribble. He looked normal to me. Again, if you didn't know about the injury, and that first half you mentioned, Tom, that we don't have the full stats. We're recording this during the game right now. The Pacers are up 100-75, 5 minutes left in the game. Benches have been cleared on the OKC side. The game is effectively over. But in the first half, the differential made threes, 9 for Indiana, 1 for Oklahoma City, 11 turnovers for the Thunder, only 2 for the Pacers, 52 shots for the Pacers, 39 for the Thunder. That was at halftime when Indiana had a 20-point lead. They extended that to 30 to begin the fourth quarter. And that's when the OKC waved the white flag immediately to start the fourth. They said, okay, it's over. We're going to a game 7. There was just no let up from Indiana. I felt like their defense was just playing this inspired, connected throughout the entire first half, throughout the first three quarters. And offensively, it was just one of those games for the Thunder where it's like nothing has fallen from three. They have these games where just nobody can do anything on offense except for SGA and J-Dub, who had good first halves, but nobody else was doing a thing for the Thunder. And you'd expect they'll be better at home in game 7. You'd expect that, but there's no guarantees of it. They've had poor shooting performances at home throughout the postseason. It's happened.
I mean, 8 turnovers for Shea. 5 in the first half. This guy was tough. Getting crowded every single time. And there were some, you know, turnovers that were unforced errors, you know, pushing guys off on off-ball screens, just losing the ball, bad passes. Jalen Williams, the pass that he made that Tyrese Haliburton picked off and then flicked a no-look pass ahead to Pascal Siakam. Like, it was karma. J-Dub should not have been that lackadaisical with that pass. And Tyrese Haliburton stole it, went the other way, gave that no-look pass, and Pascal Siakam put on a poster of posters. Look at this thing, man. J-Dub contested it. Hallelujah to you. Like, praise you for trying to contest that layup. But, man, that is going to be a play for the ages. I said it was the play of the year in the moment. Maybe I was living in the moment at that time. But you talk about the stakes, the moment. J-Dub turning the ball over and then going the other way and trying to block Pascal Siakam's dunk there. It was, I mean, one of the best finals plays you'll ever see. If the Indiana Pacers pull this off, we will be talking about that play right there as when it all went downhill for the Thunder. Look, man, Kev, this 6 minute, 48 second stretch between the end of the second quarter and the beginning of the third quarter, the Thunder were held scoreless. I'm going to read to you, Kev, the 11 possessions that went down with the Oklahoma City Thunder, 68-win team this year. Chet Holmgren, turnover. J-Dub, turnover. Shea Gilgeous-Alexander, miss. Chet Holmgren gets the offensive rebound, miss the jumper. Lou Dort missed another three. Shea Gilgeous-Alexander, bad pass, turnover. J-Dub missed three. Caruso got blocked at the rim. Chet Holmgren gets the ball, missed three again. Lou Dort missed another three. Shea Gilgeous-Alexander missed a layup, and then he missed another jumper. That is 11 possessions, 3 turnovers, 5 missed threes, and 5 missed twos. Can't let that happen.
Crazy.
OKC crazy. Can't let that happen in the finals closeout game. They are on the brink of winning the NBA championship, and they go almost 7 minutes without scoring. I've never seen anything like it.
There's a moment early in the game. It was 10-2. And I'm thinking, well, we're going to get the game we all thought we were going to get. And then everything that you just described happened. All of it happened afterwards. And for the Pacers, there was a moment in that first quarter, like I said, where I felt like, you know, maybe this is going to be an OKC blowout in the first half and it's going to be over. But Andrew Nembhard scored 8 straight points, didn't let the game get out of hand when OKC got off to a good start. Pacers, insert TJ McConnell, insert Tony Bradley in that first half. Tony Bradley, the energy he played with force in an OKC timeout. McConnell, deflections, spin moves into the paint for layups, pull up, fading jumpers, diving on the floor, winning 50-50 balls. the dude did it again. Like him, like Tony Bradley and TJ McConnell in those minutes, they gave the Pacers at the time what was their biggest lead of the series, 12. They're up 45-33 in the second quarter, pushed it to 13, and obviously it ballooned all the way up to 30 entering the fourth quarter. But, I mean, just some of those little moments in the first half, Nembhard, 8 straight points, McConnell, Bradley, I think they took a blow, a punch from OKC early in the game, but then they just walloped them rest of the game. And McConnell doing it again, man. Oh, man. I mean, did you see the NBA University post today where he's like, well, if you gave McConnell 38 minutes, he'd be like Jalen Brunson. He could like lead, be an engine of an offense. And I responded, oh, I was wow. like, let's settle down. Let's relax. Let's relax now. Let's relax. But the fact that McConnell is even inspiring those thoughts from a really smart guy, NBA University is a great account on social. The fact TJ McConnell's playing at this level, it says a lot.
I mean, when you talk about 12 points, 6 assists, and 9 rebounds, like the guy was filling up the box score at 24. What if Jalen Brunson had just 24 minutes? How about that? If Jalen Brunson had just 24 minutes, could he play as energized as TJ McConnell and do all the little things like TJ McConnell does? Kev, this is an unbelievable, unbelievable turn of events for the Indiana Pacers. If you talk about losing game 6 by 20 plus, that's only happened 3 times in NBA history when you're in the finals, losing game 6 by more than 20 points with a chance to close out. 1970, the Knicks lost by 22 to the Lakers, and then they went and beat the Lakers by 14 to win the championship. In 1978, I'm sorry, Seattle fans, this is kind of rubbing salt in the wound here. The Washington Bullets, they won by 35 in game 6 and then won again over the Supersonics. And then 2010, the Lakers win 22 against Boston in game 6 and then win again in game 7. So the teams who lose game 6 by more than 20 points in a closeout game like OKC, in the 3 times that it's happened in NBA history, they've gone 1-2. So this is not a good look for the Oklahoma City Thunder. They've got home court, but so do those other two teams, and they weren't able to close out.
That's an interesting stat there. And I mean, obviously, like every team is its own independent story. But I mean, losing like this in a game 6 is rough. It's rough. But at the same time, though, Tom, this kind of does follow a very similar formula what we saw in round 2 against Denver, where they get beat up in game 6. You know, there's thoughts about, you know, maybe the Nuggets are going to actually win this series. They lost that game only by 12. They're getting smoked in this one. But then they come out in game 7. They win 125-93 and have their best game plan for that game, for that moment against Jokic, putting Caruso on him. So it can flip the other way, too, with the Thunder blow out the Pacers at home in game 7 on Sunday. What's your early expectation of game 7? Your first initial thought about how that game's going to go? Are we going to get a classic? Are we going to get a blowout? What are you expecting?
I have no idea, dude. I have no idea. The Pacers, like, I mean, the Pacers could win by 40. Like, that's the kind of storybook season that they've had. I wouldn't be surprised by anything. OKC wins by 40. Like, an earthquake happens in game 7. Wouldn't be surprised. Like, this is just no idea. Like, I don't know. And, like, look, Mark Daigneault, he's being outcoached in this series. Like, the Thunder were picked by some people to sweep. I picked him in 5, and so did everybody. Me and too. Their grandmother picked him in 5. Right? And they're going to game 7, and who's the one who's been switching their starting lineups left and right? It's Daigneault. Comes out game 1, moves away from the 2 big lineup, and puts Kaysom Wallace into the starting lineup, abandons that a couple of games later, and then tonight we see Alex Caruso starting the second half for Isaiah Hartenstein, and that didn't go well. They were scoreless for the first 4 minutes of the second half. So I feel like they're really scrambling here. The Thunder are still on the back heels, and got to give credit to Tyrese Haliburton, Pascal Siakam, Obi Toppin. I mean, play after play after play, they are taking it to Oklahoma City, and it looks like they have the momentum going into game 7.
Yeah, it does feel like that. And like, again, we'll see how actually the game goes. Momentum can fizzle. Like, every game is its own independent thing. But at the same time, this Pacers team has something special about them. They have something special about them. With the type of comebacks they've had every single series, the game 1 against OKC as well, And now Halliburton hurt and everybody else stepping up in the ways they've had. You cannot rule out this team doing something spectacular and upsetting a team that everybody was crowning as a future dynasty, as a team that's going to win multiple titles before they win their first title. You cannot rule out this Pacers team being that spoiler, being that team that is indeed a Cinderella, indeed a special team in NBA history that continue to beat the odds. This is part of their story, really. Like, even going back to earlier in the season, they were not a great team before mid-December. They became a great team in mid-December, January, and they increasingly got better throughout the year. They started out slow. And they started out in the postseason looking like they're going to lose a lot of those games, and they come back. And if they, this is just following a trend. And so that's where, like, you know, you say, I expect anything in game seven. I agree with you. OKC, you expect 68 win team, dominant defense. They should come out with the best game plan like they have in past closeout games. With Indiana, you expect this team that has done the unthinkable time and time and time and again throughout the entire season and throughout the postseason to do it again, because here we are, right? They're down 3-2. They win a game at home. Can they do it on the road? It could rival. A 3-1 comeback is different. What the Cavs did against the Warriors, 3-1 comebacks are a different level. But the Halliburton injury does make this one feel extra, extra special for the Pacers if they were to be able to pull this one off. I just can't believe it's been 9 years, Tom. 9 years since we had a game seven.
Yeah.
That's hard to believe, man. We've had a lot of crappy finals. We've had a lot of finals that are five gamers and blowouts, like not like blowouts where it's just like not even close. Like last year, Boston, Dallas wins one game. It's a blowout. The series wasn't all that interesting. I was worried that this series was going to be like that, but it's been the best one. I think it might be the best one. And I've covered the NBA since 2013. Let's see. So we'll see how game seven goes, but Cavs, Warriors, and Heat, Spurs. It's going to be hard to top those two. Very hard to top those two, at least in my years covering the league. But who knows? We'll see what magic could happen.
You take the names off the back and the names off the front of these jerseys, and the basketball, I think, has been the best that I've seen. Like in the NBA finals. I think that's a good point.
Yes.
Yeah. You know, like if it's not LeBron, what it's not it? Steph, Tim Duncan. Like,
can you share your stat from the big number this week about miles? And just is amazing.
The miles traveled in this series between these two games. It's just incredible. The level of the defense that is full court, 94 feet, 50 feet wide. Like this matchup is insane. When you talk about the competitiveness, 38.4 miles covered by these two teams in the NBA finals. That is the most in the player tracking era since 2014. 38 miles covered. And the norm is like 32, 33, 34. They're at 38 miles per game. Last year, they had 4.5 miles covered fewer per game in the Boston and Dallas series. And these teams, they like refuse to switch. They want to fight over screens. They want to press you full court. They want to rotate so hard to make sure you got no airspace. And if you are a coach and you have young kids watching these NBA finals, they're going to be 10% better tomorrow. They're going to be 10% better at basketball by watching these two teams play. And the way that they fight over screens, the way that they contest everything, the way that they dive on loose balls, the way they use fundamentals, the footwork, the pump fakes, like everything you see, the ball movement. Like Tyrese Haliburton, maybe you don't want to copy Tyrese Haliburton's jump passes. Caitlin Cooper has written about this extensively and how Tyrese Haliburton is like doing the cardinal sin that like coaches hate is jump passes. But he's been doing it electrifyingly the last few years, and like 38 miles per game these two teams cover. It's just it's 10-20% more than we normally see in the finals. And you gotta take your hat off to Rick Carlisle and Mark Daigneault. These two teams, they're going so hard, and I'm so glad we get a game. We deserve a game seven with these two teams, man. We deserve it.
I think your stat perfectly captures what we've seen, right? Like we're seeing high effort. We're seeing coverage 94 feet. We're seeing pick and rolls behind the half court line. Like we're seeing some weird stuff that you don't normally see. You never see during the regular season. I've had a lot of conversations with people around the NBA, like, because it's draft time, and people are like, oh, like, these two teams are changing the way we think about, like, who we need. We're changing our evaluations of guys. Like, who are the guys that have stamina? Who are the guys that play hard constantly? Who are the guys that are self-motivators? Who are the, I think it's changing the way certain people think about that. It's not that you didn't value those things before. Of course, you always valued those types of qualities. But, like, Tom, I think the extremes in which this series is reaching, as you accurately described, is making people think a lot about team building and how, like, under this new CBA, with all its restrictions and all its challenges, how do you build to be able to have depth and be able to sustain this level of intensity from minute one tip off to minute 48 final buzzer? How do you find guys that can play this style of play? And so this time of year, like, it's draft time, it's trade season, like, everything's happening all at once during the finals. And I think this series, it's always a copycat league. But this series is, I think, putting a lot into perspective about the important qualities.
I think Kev, you're right about this thing. Is, like, I think teams are drafting differently based on these finals, or at least the final four, and just how young these teams are. It makes me wonder, yeah, these guys are on the market, but you have to kind of give up a bunch of players to make it happen. And I think it really makes a premium. It puts a premium on draft night. You look at OKC and Indiana, the way that they drafted and acquired these young players, it really makes a difference when you're able to get Tyrese Haliburton after his rookie season, or Shai Gilgeous-Alexander after his rookie season. You got to be able to develop. And you look at these two teams and their ability to draft well on draft night and acquire these young players right after the rookie season, and Tyrese Haliburton and Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, it really puts a premium on draft night. And so that's why Wednesday night is super important for a lot of these teams, because you can't really get them in free agency. And trading guys, you kind of have to gut your roster to acquire these big name players. So I think a lot of teams are having to draft and develop. And I think that is the new era that we're looking at, that we are on the frontier of what these two teams are doing, building young and building internally and developing, and you're seeing the style of play. I don't think you do that when you just kind of have these hired guns, these older players. That's not the way that these two teams are built, and I think teams are drawing lessons from it.
Thank you, everybody, for participating, watching us live on YouTube, TikTok, Facebook, X. Give us a like if you have not done so already. Give us a thumbs up. It does help out the video. Eric Weiss in the YouTube chat said, no ball stoppers, no low processors, no one-way players. And I think that sums it up perfectly, Tom. You cannot have one-way guys. You can't have guys that slow down the offense, who screw up on defense. You cannot have those types of guys. They can't survive in a series. Like, can you imagine any of those types of players playing against Indiana with their speed on offense, the way they get the ball up in a jiffy, the way they move so fast in the half court, the way OKC is able to just throw these dogs at you on ball? You can't play that way. You really can't play that way. Like, you have no chance to survive at this level of the NBA Finals. And Indiana has a roster that is able to handle this OKC defense. And this OKC team is going against something they've never seen before, with this Pacers team that doesn't have those holes on offense or on defense, for that matter. And that's why we're in a Game 7. That's why we're going to have a Game 7 on Sunday, despite everything pointing towards tonight being a blowout, despite OKC being a team everybody picked in five. This is why we got it, because this Pacers team has been underrated. I underrated them all the way, the whole season. I said they were a league pass darling. They were much more. They're an NBA Finals darling. It's really what they were, not just a league pass darling. And yeah, here we are, Tom. I can't believe it.
Do you think that Ace Bailey is just heartbroken to have this NBA Finals playing right now, right around draft time? Because, I mean, I just feel, whether it's true, putting those two things together, that the rumors are, or that his draft stock is falling, that he's potentially falling out of that number three slot that a lot of people have been expecting, I can't look at that, the way that he plays basketball and the way that the Rutgers, you know, the supporting cast wasn't there for Ace Bailey and Dylan Harper. But still, I mean, maybe I'm connecting two dots that shouldn't be connected, but it just feels like a guy like that, I just can't put him in this kind of NBA Finals environment. Like I just can't imagine a guy who is that kind of low IQ player who's not able to get to the cup, doesn't play defense, and is kind of this mold of clay. I can understand why teams are like, you know what? Like, are you seeing these two teams play in the finals? Can I picture a guy like that playing in this environment? I can understand why his stock is falling a little bit.
Yeah, I think with Ace Bailey, he sees himself as a star go-to scorer. And that's what he wants to be. That's the track he wants to be on. That's why he canceled his workout with the Sixers. As reported this week, he was supposed to work out with them on Friday, meet with the team in Philadelphia. That is not happening. He is continuing his run of no known workouts with any teams, which is baffling. And he still thinks he's going to be drafted in the top three, which maybe he will be. Maybe a team moves up. But it sure seems like Ace Bailey doesn't want to be on a team that plays this way, that plays like Indiana, that plays like Oklahoma City, unless he's SGA, unless he is the star of the team, getting all the buckets, getting all the shots. The problem is, and so, look, I think with Ace Bailey, he is undeniably very talented. He's 6'7". He is uber athletic. He's a guy who can throw down lob dunks. He makes these amazing plays. He hits these crazy jumpers and all that. I just don't think he's as great as he thinks he is. And that's where, like, so for Sixers fans that were talking about Ace Bailey as the potential number three pick, a lot of the time their conversation was about, hey, Ace Bailey hit 39% of his catch and shoot threes this year at Rutgers. If we have him taking spot up threes, attacking closeouts, a simplified role, he could be really, really efficient, really, really good for our team, really good for our team, and he could develop good habits. The problem is, Ace Bailey sees himself as the guy who does all the creation. And that's where I look at it. Like, I'm not too focused on some of this weird pre-draft cycle stuff. Like, I think it matters, but I'm still mostly concerned about the on-court flaws with him, because with Ace Bailey this past year at Rutgers, he made only 36.4% of his pull-up two-pointers. And by the way, those pull-up two-pointers made up two-thirds of his entire shot diet. Two-thirds of his shots were 36.4% makes pull-up twos, 24.4% on pull-up threes. So he's not a lights-out shooter off the dribble from mid-range or from three. He gets to the rim very infrequently, and when he does, he made only 42% of his layups in the half court. So with Ace Bailey, man, like, the on-court flaws suggest this is a guy who fancies himself an on-ball dominant guy that doesn't want to play this Indiana style, doesn't want to play this OKC style with a lot of motion like Indiana, more, you know, ball sharing in Oklahoma City, hard-nosed, tough, selfless play on the Thunder. He wants to play for the Nets, who have literally nobody on their roster, or the Wizards, that have not a lot going on for them with a foundation right now. He wants to play for a team like that. And to me, that inherently is a red flag when you could say he could play for the Sixers, who, whatever you want to say about Joel Embiid, whatever you want to say about him, the Sixers are better suited to contend early on in Ace Bailey's career. And the fact he wouldn't want to go there to play with Embiid and Maxey and Jared McCain and a bunch of really good role players and contribute to winning, to me, that's a red flag. And it says a lot about his mindset and his approach. And that's concerning to me.
When you're scoring 0.7 points per shot at the college level at that size, you're not going to make it in the league with that. You can get excused for your freshman year at Rutgers doing that kind of inefficiency, high volume scoring. But the numbers you presented, it won't fly in the NBA. Like, Benedict Mathurin might be the closest comp, or maybe Aaron Wiggins in this series, of a guy who's just like a microwave scorer off the bench. But those guys, they're actually efficient. Ace Bailey, the way you're describing it, it seems like he doesn't belong to be in the first round with those kind of numbers. Just the inefficiency. Well,
he belongs in the first round. I think I need to make that clear. Like, the negatives are very negative, but at the same time, Tom, he is 6'7". He's got a good handle. He is able to get off really high degree of difficulty shots. And throughout the season at Rutgers, his effort got a little bit better on defense. He showed a little bit more willingness to pass, which shows some adaptability. And so there's upside with him. There's major upside, but there's also just major, major downside. Whereas other guys, Con Knipple, you can see he's going to be a good player. It's just a matter of what level he reaches. Trey Johnson, you know he's an elite shooter. It's just a matter of what everything else happens with him. What other parts of his game develop? Like, there's other guys you can look at in the similar range as Ace Bailey and say, well, maybe they have a slightly lower ceiling, but they have a way, 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 way higher floor than Ace Bailey and still a comparable ceiling. So I think he belongs still in the lottery, but I wouldn't want to draft him. I wouldn't draft him. I would not want to draft Ace Bailey unless I'm a team where it's like I'm in my first year as a GM and I'm like, screw it. We'll take a huge swing with the ninth pick. Not number three. Not number three.
So I'm watching right now Dagnall talking after the game. There was stuff, this is the quote, there was stuff that I thought we could have controlled that could have been better. So we have to own that. We'll look at it. We'll learn from it like we always do. And then we got to obviously be much better going into game seven. I mean, credit Indiana. He says they outplayed us for the most of the 48 minutes. That's the story of the game. They went out there and attacked the game. From our standpoint, it was uncharacteristic. It was disappointing. Yeah, you think? You think like Dagnall's not going to come out here and breathe fire on his teammates. Like, that's not his personality. That's not the way he coaches. That's not the way that they got 68 wins and got to the NBA finals. Yeah, it's incredible to hear a coach say that was disappointing, you know, but you gotta say, yeah, when you lose by that much in a closeout game in game six, that's bad. That's bad. So yeah, Dagnall, they're talking right now. And it just feels like there's not much you can say after that game, what we just witnessed from OKC side and the way they got embarrassed in game six. They've done it before, like you said, against Denver. They won in game seven. We haven't seen a game seven from Indiana, but this is something that I think Indiana can build on, and they get that draft pick back in that trade with New Orleans. And I just, it would be a real shame if we go into next season and continue to doubt this Indiana Pacers team. I know it's going to happen because they don't have a big name player, even though we watch Pascal Siakam do what he did tonight and Tyrese Haliburton playing on that bum calf strain and doing what he did. And those threes from downtown from the logo, this Indiana team, it's going to be hard to pick anybody coming out of the East next year after what they did tonight. I know that might seem just like a real knee-jerk reaction to game six, but like what you do to OKC, the best team in the NBA from start to finish up to this point, and you beat them by basically 30 points, incredible. Sorry for the detour. I just, yeah.
No, you sparked a thought in my mind. I just want to rant about this real quick. The people who said Haliburton shouldn't have played tonight are insane. The people who before the game are saying, well, I wouldn't have played. I don't think it should be out there. Are you nuts? Have you ever competed? Like, are you kidding me? Are you kidding me? Of course he should be out there. This could be his last time ever in the NBA Finals. Ever. You don't know if the Pacers are ever going to make it back. You don't know how things are going to change in your career or in your team's trajectory. Of course he's going to play tonight. And he lit a fire on his team and he played really well. And now they have a chance to win the damn series on Sunday. And if he didn't play, they might have be over. It might be OKC, you know, celebration right now, getting the finals MVP trophy to SGA or Jalen Williams. And we're debating that on the postgame show. Oh, well, why did Sam Amick vote for Jalen Williams? Like, I don't know what we'd be talking about. Who knows what we'd be talking about if that had happened, if Haliburton didn't play. Of course he should have played tonight. Of course he should.
Yeah, and I go back and forth on this. Like, yes, he should have played. But we have seen Damian.
Don't go back and forth.
I am. I will say Kevin Durant. You could say the same thing about Kevin Durant.
You could argue KD should have played earlier in that series.
In 2019, you're saying, against Toronto.
Yeah.
I'm not going to hold it against any player who says, like, I'm playing, it's the finals. I'm just saying from a medical standpoint, you can see why people would be like, all right, go ahead. It's your risk. It's the NBA Finals. Go for it. Mm-hmm. But I can understand why.
Exactly, Tom. It's your risk. It's him taking agency over his own life and making a choice that he wants to do. And I just think, like, if any competitor, in this moment down 3-2 in the finals, who would say, nah, I don't. I just, unless, like, you literally can't play and you're a liability to your team, that's different. Yeah. But he was able to make an effort and play really well and gut it out. And I have the utmost respect for Tyrese Haliburton. No matter what happens in game seven, he earned my respect for the rest of his career for gutting this out with what looks like it should have been a multi-week injury that would hold him out for a long period of time.
Yeah. Remember OG Anunoby last year where he had that hamstring and he just couldn't move and they took him out of the game and they were like, yeah, you're a liability out there.
At least he's
Tyrese Haliburton tonight. He looked great. He looked great. The way he was playing defense, he was attacking, he was moving, he was stunning on screens, he was getting out in transition, like all these things that you wanted to see from Tyrese Haliburton. He looked great. And his energy was popping off the screen, getting the crowd involved, hitting huge shots, stepping into those shots. And on the other side, there was a couple times where Jalen Williams they were letting him shoot threes. They were like, yeah, go step into these threes. And they were playing drop coverage basically against a dude who scored 40 points, 6 rebounds, and 5 assists in the last game. And this dude, Jalen Williams, in game 6, after that statement legacy game in game 5, a minus 40, Kev, in game 6. So, like, when I say I don't know what to expect in game 7, that's it right there. Jalen Williams had the game of his life in game 5 and then had an absolute stinker in game 6.
Jack Thomas in the YouTube chat said, was Tyrese actually hurt or was that a smoke? He's actually hurt. All my sources I've talked to have said that he is, like, legit in real pain. Like, this is an injury that he's dealing with. I know you said opening your third eye.
Yeah, that's all.
But he's hurt. As far as I know, this is sheer effort and determination and heart and gut and grit, and that I respect Tyrese Haliburton for it. Let's go back a little bit to some NBA offseason stuff because we did get some news this week. The Lakers, they sold $10 billion. $10 billion, highest valuation for an NBA team ever, surpassing the Celtics, $6.1 billion just earlier this year. Hard to believe, Tom. Celtics and Lakers both getting sold in the same year. And I think with the Lakers sale here, it's almost been universal praise for the Lakers selling the team here to Mark Walter, because Walter owns the Dodgers. They've had immense success. And it's not just because the Dodgers are big spenders. They are forward-thinking in the front office. They made significant investments in that front office, whereas the Lakers barely have a pro personnel department underneath Rob Pelinka. Barely at all. It's like the bus boys and not much else in the front office compared to all these other teams that have full staffs throughout the entire department, international people within their own city. The Lakers don't have many bodies in the front office. And so I'd expect they're going to change some of those things under Mark Walter, in addition to being a team that maybe is able to afford going for their number one option as a head coach. Maybe next time they're able to get Ty Lue instead of settling for their second, third, or fourth choice because of those deeper pockets. It's not just about the investment on the payroll of the team when we know about the CBA restrictions for the players themselves, but ultimately, it's been universal praise from Lakers fans, despite the bus family selling here. Whereas you see the Mavericks sale happens, it's scary. The Suns fans are happy about a sale, getting rid of Sarver. Well, not so happy with what's happened since then under Ishbia. There's uncertainty with the Celtics now, going from Wick Grosbeck to Chisholm. You don't know what this new ownership is going to look like. But the Lakers, Walter's done great with the Dodgers. And so you've seen it work within your own city, and there's a high level of confidence with it happening with the Lakers. Do you see any reason for concern though, Tom?
No. And the thing that really is the story here is Luka Doncic going on X and saying, the Lakers are an amazing organization. I'm looking forward to meeting Mark and excited about the future. I am also grateful to Jeannie and the Buss family for welcoming me to LA. And I'm happy that Jeannie will continue to be involved. And then here's the kicker. I look forward to working with both of them to win championships. Kev, this guy's a free agent potentially next summer. And he just tweeted out in the response to a ownership change that the Buss family is selling, Luka Doncic is saying, I want to win multiple championships here. So this is a huge win. And I can't say that this is mutually exclusive. I think the sale happens in part because they have this wonder kid, this 27-year-old Luka Doncic on their team. And if you look at his workouts this summer, I'm buying it, man. I'm buying it. I know we did this with Ben Simmons every offseason and like, oh, look, his jumper's back. Wow. I'm workout watching.
Ben Simmons looks great. Ben Simmons shoots with the wrong hand. There's plenty of guys that can shoot well in an open gym. And Ben Simmons also shoots with the wrong hand. Luka, he does look good. He looks good.
He does.
And we'll see if he can sustain it. But that's the thing. I gain weight during the season. I have terrible habits during the NBA season. My belly gets a little bit bigger. I got to lose it during the summer. It's hard. Like, it's just a lot of time invested. Never mind when you're an athlete. With him, he probably just has poor habits during the season. It's about, to me, that's my concern with Luka. I have no doubts this is real during the summer right now. It's just about, can he develop better habits during the course of the season and not gain weight back and get in worse condition physically over the course of the season. With that said, he's been to an NBA Finals and a Conference Finals, and now with the Lakers, they should reload and have an even better roster around him, despite some of the conditioning concerns there. That's what's scary about what he could be if he's actually in peak condition. We saw what it turned Jokic into, right, Tom?
Mm-hmm. And I do think that this is going to be an interesting summer for the Lakers in terms of like how they rebuild around those two guys, LeBron James and Luka Doncic. I think everything's going to be on the table because now you got new ownership. And yeah, Jeannie Buss is still the governor, but there's a new sheriff in town. And he has remade the Dodgers and has done this time and time again across sports, multiple sports leagues, whether it's racing or whether it's the WNBA, whether it's soccer or baseball. Like, Mark Walter is someone who comes in and improves majority of those efforts. He has improved the organization and ramped things up big time. So what does this mean for the rest of the league? I was talking to some folks before this happened. Why hasn't the expansion happened yet? And I think this is related to it, is maybe the owners right now are seeing these skyrocketing sales for their franchises. And maybe they're looking at this and like, why are we going to dilute our pie? Like, if we're going to sell the Lakers for $10 billion, yes, that might mean that the franchise fee for, say, Las Vegas or, say, for Seattle are going up and that they can get a lot of money right there, a short-term hit, but a long-term dilution of the slice of their pie. So our team's going to look at this $10 billion valuation for the Lakers and say, hey, we want to keep a hold of our slice of the pie rather than thinning it out by adding two teams. And I wonder if the expansion talks are kind of on ice right now because of that, because these owners are like, man, we're making a lot of money right now. I don't see why we need to, you know, basically take a smaller cut of the revenues every year to bring in these new teams. And I will say, like, the Los Angeles Lakers getting Walter, does it make more sense or less sense to add a Las Vegas team in that market? I mean, I think those two things are going to be impacting each other, considering that a lot of Vegas people and residents are Lakers fans. And so if LeBron James is going to be part of the new ownership in Vegas, like he says he wants to be, but now you got Mark Walter over here, that will complicate things. I don't see expansion becoming more likely after this deal.
I'm not sold Vegas makes total sense for exactly the reason you just hit. Not sold. I mean, I think Vegas is a great market. We've seen the Aces and the W have great success there, a really good fan base. The Raiders moving there have had, you know, the fan base has been behind them in Vegas. Obviously, it's heartbreaking for Oakland, but Vegas has been a good host for franchise. It's been a good host for the NBA with the NBA Cup, with NBA Summer League. I can't wait till Summer League next month. It's one of the best times of the year. The arena's full on the first day when Cooper Flagg plays. It's going to be an awesome atmosphere. I can't wait. It's going to be fun. If the Lakers get a first-round pick through a trade somehow, Lakers fans are going to show up, and it's going to be wild there. When it comes to expansion, though, I'm not not positive about Vegas for a team. Seattle, yes, please. Like, let's get the Supersonics back. But with that Mark Spears quote you see on the screen right there, he said, I talked to a high-level person in the NBA today, and they said it's leaning towards perhaps expansion coming soon this summer. After that, he said these words, but it's not a no-brainer. So he's not exactly saying this is going to happen or this isn't going to happen, just that he talked to somebody in the league office that says it's leaning towards an announcement this offseason. I don't know, Tom. Maybe, but I'm not so sure here, man. I just think with that, with the NBA, the Sonics are a no-brainer. It's a matter of when, not if. But Vegas, I don't know. I'm not sure about Vegas. And I do think I think it will be Vegas. I think it will be. But I'm just not sure about the timing here, because it was supposed to happen. What was it, like 3 years ago? Everybody expected it to be for the 26-27 season. Well, that's not going to happen. I don't think so. I didn't think it would have to be 27-28, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah. And I do think there's another piece of this is Jeannie Buss is maintaining control of the team in terms of she's going to be the governor for the Lakers. Yeah. But I do think
they said that about Mark Cuban, too, with Dallas. I know it's a little different with Jeannie. She still owns
it. It was in writing, apparently. The reports say that she had it in writing. That is part of the execution of this deal, that she has it in writing that she's going to be the governor. But as we see with the Charlotte Hornets or in other organizations, there's kind of a transfer of power. Is that like maybe Jeannie Buss has it in her contract? She controls for like two more years and then she passes the baton. But when that time comes, we're going to look around the NBA. And we're probably not going to have LeBron playing anymore. Maybe not Steph Curry. Maybe not Kevin Durant. We're also not going to have Mark Cuban as an owner. And we're not going to have Michael Jordan as an owner. Like, think about those names that are not going to be a part of our NBA life. This NBA is going through a huge transition over the next 5 years. And the fact that the Buss family sold, Mark Cuban sold, and Michael Jordan is out of being in ownership, and he was with the Wizards before that. These owner meetings are going to, and Gruce Beck too, with the Boston Celtics, these ownership meetings are going to look very different. And the dynamic and the landscape of the NBA is going to be unrecognizable in 5 years. It is going to change so much, not just because of on the floor, but also the most important people, the owners of these teams. It's going to have a very different dynamic with all of those very powerful people now out of the NBA.
I mean, everything's going to change. The broadcast partners have changed. Games are going to be on Amazon and NBC. We'll see what happens with RSNs in the years to come as well. Like, things are constantly changing at every single level with the NBA. The whole CBA changed team building. It changed from the team front office side of things. It's changing for everything. The NIL changed the way players are entering the draft. Like, the whole freaking ecosystem of basketball has completely changed. You got college basketball talking about having quarters instead of halves. Like, literally everything is changing right now. The game is going to look unrecognizable. And I don't think it's a bad thing necessarily. I mean, I hope a lot of these changes are positive. But the expansion one's a big one. Ultimately, I do hope the league expands. I think the NBA would benefit from having 32 teams. If it's Seattle, yes. And Vegas, sure. That'd be great. Like, I think the fan base would be behind them there, despite the overlap with the Lakers, as you said. And I think expansion would be an opportunity to also change the schedule again. We see the in-season tournament. We see the play-in tournament. I think the NBA, their long-term vision is to further expand the in-season tournament. Maybe you bring in international teams. They announced their intentions to create an international league in Europe. We'll see when or if that ends up happening. The NBA wants to expand that aspect of the schedule. I think having 32 teams, you could face everybody twice, play 62 games a year, plus an in-season tournament aspect of the schedule. So it still comes out to around 80 total games that you're playing. There's ways for them to get creative that I believe they are talking about and thinking about. And I think they want to get that ironed out completely for whenever it is that they announce expansion. I don't think things are going to just stay exactly the same once they expand. I think more is going to change that's going to be attached to the expansion, a full overhaul of what the whole NBA calendar looks like. That's my expectation based off of the conversations I've had with people around the league for the last 5 years or so. Like, these are ideas that have been bouncing around, like, you know, in 2020, 2019, 2018. Like, all of that expansion talk has been going on a long time. Since the last time we had a game seven, those talks have been going on in 2016, 9 years ago. So that's just, I just think the league, that's what they want to do. And they're trying to get it right before they make the full announcement. And we'll see. That's why I think they're going to be patient. This summer does feel soon, though. It just feels like it would come out of nowhere, but we'll see.
Yeah. Yeah. And what I'm really wanting, Kev, is, as you're describing it, 32 teams in an in-season tournament. Give me a tournament style. Give it to me. 32 teams.
Single elimination
tournament. March Madness, call it November Madness, whatever it is. Yeah. It would be awesome. You know what? Like, how NFL just took the NBA's lunch on Christmas Day. Like, the NBA could do the same thing with an in-season tournament with 32 teams in a single elimination tournament. Like, it would be awesome. It would be great TV. And I know people are like, oh, what about tradition? And oh, what about this and that? We don't need to throw a gimmick into the season. Who cares? Like, we can't have the same thing. You can't complain about, like, the endless regular season and not having stakes and also complain about a single elimination tournament in the middle of the season. Like, we can't have both things.
A single elimination would be unbelievable. It would be incredible. It might be better than the playoffs. Might be.
Yeah.
Might be.
Game seven, we're talking about our favorite two words in sports, game seven. You know why? Because it's a single elimination tournament. It's do or die. It's go home. Win or go home. Like, that's what it would be for every single night. It'd be awesome. That's what I'm rooting for, Ken.
I know. I'm rooting for it too. And ultimately, when it comes to tradition, I understand the fans and the players who talk about tradition. Like, there was just that clip of LeBron on his pod, Mind the Game, talking about, well, if you move to 40 minutes, the product might improve, like, minutes would have more urgency. Like, he's right about all those things. He's like, but then again, you'd have to talk about all the records and how it would impact tradition and the historical numbers and stuff like that. That's all true and all, but at the same time, like, the game evolves, the league evolves. You could say the same thing about when they added a three-point line and how that impacted the numbers prior to adding the three-point line, or rule changes, like, to deter Wilt Chamberlain from being able to score 50 points per game, guiding the ball into the rim, like, expanding the key. The rules have always changed in the NBA, getting rid of hand checking, that's opening the perimeter. Like, the rules are always changing. The league has always expanded. So I think that's kind of captures, like, what sports is. It's always evolving and always changing. And ultimately, in the day and age we live in now, the NBA isn't just competing against the NFL. They're not just competing against baseball and hockey. They're competing against TikTok. They're competing against Instagram Reels, like, funny slot videos that get fed to you by the algorithm. They're competing against Netflix prestige TV series that get millions and millions of dollars thrown into them to produce. They're competing against these shows and these movies and all this stuff because it's about entertainment. And that's what the NBA is at the end of the day. It's there to entertain. Whether it is, like, you follow for the trades and the transactions or the rumors and the gossip and the off-court stuff or the X's and O's and all that type of stuff, whatever it is from the NBA, you're entertained by it. You enjoy it. You like it. And the competition is everything in the content world, everything in the entertainment world. And so it's single elimination tournament, Tom. That would be peak entertainment for the NBA, just like a game seven is.
To go back to what you're saying about the 40-minute quarters, I think or 40-minute games, I think the biggest dilemma is going to be with the players' union. Because if we go to 40-minute games, will that cut out a lot of the rank and file NBA players from getting any playing time?
God, it's gone.
Gone. God. You know? I mean,
these stars are still going to play 30, 35 minutes. And that means, like, let's just say for the Thunder, for example, SGA is still getting 35, 36 of those 40 minutes. And so that means, Cason Wallace might get 5 instead of 14. That's what it would turn into.
Exactly. And the rosters would probably shrink. I mean, that's the real dilemma for the players union is, I guess on one hand, you could argue that the stars would potentially be healthier because they're not having to play a 48-minute game. But the question is whether they are going to play a proportionally smaller number of minutes. You know, if they're playing 30 minutes in a 48-minute game, do they go down to 25 minutes in a 40-minute game? I don't think they do. And I think that begs the question for the players' union is, if 90% of your constituents in the union, your union members, are going to see fewer minutes because of this and not get the kind of numbers that they would need to get a big contract, is that something that they would want, the rank and file would want to do? And so I think Adam Silver has floated this on the Dan Patrick Show as like one of the ideas that he gets excited about, or that one of the ideas that like we could potentially be seeing. We tried this in like the preseason, I feel like back in like 2013 or 2014, and it didn't go very well. And it is interesting to see LeBron kind of coming around on this idea, because I feel like he was one of the biggest detractors of the 40-minute idea way back when. But you know what? When you're 40 years old and you're hurting that much in the morning and you're looking at,
And you get the points and you're the points leader already. You got your records.
I was going to say that too. Is like, I think baseball, like your nostalgic baseball is all about the records and stuff. I don't feel the same way about the NBA. I don't. Like the records, I don't feel like it's the same thing, especially with the supercharged era with Wilt and Oscar in the 60s, early 60s, where they're averaging 150 points a game. Like the eras change. I don't feel like I'm clutching pearls about the records. Like I don't think that's as big of a deal as it is in other sports. So I think 40-minute games, if you do it, you do it because it makes sense from a health standpoint and an entertainment standpoint. I don't think you should pull it off the table because of records. I think that that's asinine.
I agree. Not because of records, but as you said, the players union may have some major, major, major issues with a 40-minute game. Two more things, Tom, we got to discuss. Cooper Flagg worked out with the Dallas Mavericks on Thursday, and all reports so far are that, as you'd expect, it was mind-blowing. It was beautiful. He was transcendent. He was incredible during the workout. Seems like we're not going to get any surprises next Wednesday with the NBA draft. Cooper Flagg will be the number one pick. And hey, congrats again to Mavericks fans. A complete beast, according to a league source that told Noah Weber.
A workout, a complete beast, shot the ball insanely well. I love workout reviews, man. I love workout reviews. When has that ever gone wrong? I know Cooper Flagg is not someone to like read too much into the workouts, but like I don't know, man. We've had so many times in the NBA where we've been burned by workout reviews. It makes it, when we watched him play on Team USA on that select team, that's all I needed to see. Just like on one day in practice, playing with LeBron and KD and Anthony Davis, and more than holding his own. That to me is better than any sort of workout he could have on June 18th, 2025. I love Cooper Flagg at Duke. I thought he was sensational. I got to see him in person twice, and he was everything and more. So I'm sounding like that guy. Whoever he talked to, I'm sounding like that guy with Cooper Flagg when I saw him.
Ime Udoka got extended by the Houston Rockets, now one of the highest paid coaches in the NBA, according to Shams Charania. So he's off the table officially for the New York Knicks and their hopes. We'll see if Jason Kidd gets an extension next with the Dallas Mavericks. And by the way, what a weird day that must have been for Cooper Flagg. He shows up and it's like Kidd is not around, and you know, Sean Sweeney's getting recruited by the Spurs, and Jared Dudley is without a contract getting recruited elsewhere. It's like, who are the coaches? Who do I get to meet? Here's Patrick Dumont and Nico Harrison. You get to meet them.
I'm going to say it. I thought of Nico Harrison when that Lakers sale happened. I was like, man, Mark Cuban hires Nico Harrison and then gets out, cashes out, and then Nico Harrison trades Luka Doncic to the Lakers, and then they go for $10 billion valuation. I'm just like, man, I hope Nico Harrison's getting a cut of that. I know it can't happen, but I trade Luka Doncic and the
passenger window of his car, maybe.
Yeah, man, like, come on, dude, that guy trades Luka, and then like weeks later they get signed for a $10 billion sale. Like, you never thought the buses would sell. You never thought the genie would sell. And then sure enough, a $10 billion valuation. It's man, what a year for Dallas Mavericks fan. What an absolute roller coaster. There needs to be investigations. Like, Congress needs to go in and see what happened with the Dallas Mavericks. Cause that's that year, the 365 days of being a Mavs fan after going to the NBA Finals and then seeing what happened after that is just, you can't make it up. The fact that Cooper Flagg went in for a workout with the number one team, the Dallas Mavericks, and couldn't really figure out who's going to be coaching the team next year because the Knicks want to hire Jason Kidd and there hasn't been an extension, but Ime Udoka gets an extension. This is madness, dude. Like, Dallas, I feel bad for Cooper Flagg. We said it a bunch of times on the show, Kev. Like, Cooper Flagg, yes, he's going to become a multimillionaire if he's not already. I'm pretty sure he is with the NIL deals that he had last year. But like,
oh, he is.
I kind of feel bad for the dude in this situation that he's walking into right now with the Dallas Mavericks and all of the uncertainty with the organization going forward.
I hope it turns into a good thing for him. I really do. I hope it turns into a great story, and I hope Mavericks fans, you know, he wins them back and they end up, because they're one of the best fan bases in the NBA. They're one of my favorite fan bases in sports. And so I hope they get one back. I hope they fall in love with the franchise again, in part because Cooper is so magnetic and becomes so great that he wins them back. But it's undeniably not ideal for him. It's just not. It's just not an ideal situation for Cooper Flagg to start his NBA career. Last thing, Tom, a guy near the end of his NBA career, Kevin Durant. Still no trade. As of 11:54 p.m. Eastern on Thursday night, still no KD trade. Sam Amick at The Athletic said on a podcast, run it back this week, I think the Timberwolves are confused because in February, the Suns were sending a message to Minnesota that Kevin would be okay going there. They got that intel, except they found out, oh, wait, you're not really talking to Kevin. You don't actually know how he feels. And so that comes off of the reports this week that KD does not want Minnesota, that Anthony Edwards is not even recruiting Kevin Durant at this point. And so Minnesota doesn't want to go all in on KD with their best offer without feeling like KD actually wants to be there. And so we still don't have a trade. Still, it seems like the teams that KD wants to go to, the Spurs, the Rockets, and the Heat, aren't making offers that satisfy what the Suns are looking for. And so here we are. Do you think we're going to get a trade on Friday or Saturday ahead of Game 7, Tom? Or is this going to linger into post-finals, into next week, and maybe even as a conversation come Wednesday on draft night?
Jaren Jackson Jr., Draymond Green, Miles Bridges, what do they all have in common?
Michigan State.
I mean, if the reason why the talks haven't gotten anywhere with the Minnesota Timberwolves, and whether it's somehow gotten lukewarm, maybe it's because they're trying to go after some other guys around the league to fulfill their Michigan State Spartan destiny. I don't know, man. Like, when you look at the situation in Phoenix, it's just a lot of miscommunication. I don't think they really know what they're doing in Phoenix with they cycling through these coaches. They trade for the unbelievably destructive no trade clause of Bradley Beal's contract. And it really is sad what the Phoenix Suns have become now, and that they're not able to get the deal that they want with Kevin Durant. And it seems like the asking price way too high. And again, we're coming back to the point of, can you see Kevin Durant playing in a series like this at age 37? So if you're going to be able, if you're going to go acquire a guy like that at 37 years old, you better be pretty sure that he's going to be able to withstand the rigors of the NBA season with the pace that it's at right now, the defense at the level that it is right now. And yeah, 10 years ago, I feel really good about giving up all those assets for Kevin Durant. But with in his injury history, I can understand why teams at this stage watching these playoffs, why they might be reticent to put in those multiple picks and a good young player for Kevin Durant.
You know, you mentioned some of the Michigan State guys. I reported prior to the deadline that one of the reasons why KD didn't want to play with Golden State is because he didn't want to play with Draymond Green again. Well, Draymond Green's salary would likely be the one that have to go out to go get Kevin Durant anyway. And so Jimmy Butler can do a lot of the stuff that Draymond Green does in the half court. He's not the defender that he is, but it would change the way your team looks if you're the Warriors. But it sure as hell would be funny if they went out and got Kevin Durant. Tough deal to pull off, by the way, just for what it's worth financially. Not impossible for them. They'd have to do it after July 1st. So it wouldn't be able to happen on draft night in all likelihood. So maybe July 1, if it lingers to that point for the Warriors and some of those other teams you mentioned with Michigan State guys, you know, we'll see with Phoenix. I think with KD, man, he's still worth a lot. He's 37. He's only got 1 year left on his deal. But ultimately, Tom, he's still one of the 10 to 20 best players in the NBA. And for Phoenix, I can understand them demanding a lot here. But as you said, can he play in this series the way the style of play is right now? Could he face Indiana? Maybe not, but it's not necessarily going to be Indiana in a series. Indiana is their own entity. Like that's the thing to remember here, too, with Kevin Durant.
Yeah. I was just saying, as good as KD was this year, 27 points a game, 6 rebounds, 4 assists, like 50-40, 90 shooting. They were 10 games under 500. Okay. Mm-hmm. So it's like,
and he's not quite as peak defensively. He's not the KD at the five Warriors guy anymore. He's still a solid defender, but not a great defender anymore.
Exactly. They're bottom three defense this year with Kevin Durant on the team for 60 plus games. So I just feel like the upside isn't nearly what it used to be. And that's true for every player, every great player at 37 years old. So I think we just have to recalibrate what teams are expecting when they get Kevin Durant.
And last thing kind of on the KD note, adjacent to that, is the Sixers Paul George stuff. There was a report this week from Andy Larson, who covers the Utah Jazz, and he said he heard rumblings that the Sixers were open to trading down from 3 to 5 with Utah giving up Paul George to Utah. There are also some rumblings out there that maybe the Nets would be open to a deal like that. They have the number 8 pick, Sixers at 3. They could absorb the salary. I've heard from a number of sources that the Sixers aren't going to do a deal like that. That maybe it's been discussed, that it's been something thrown out there, but Philly would be going for something else. Something I have not heard, but I speculate about, is why would the Sixers not try to trade Paul George and more assets to go get Kevin Durant? I have not heard that. To be clear, I'm not reporting that. But when you look at this team and the position that they're in, Kevin Durant is a clear-cut upgrade over Paul George. And if they're throwing out future picks, maybe even giving up number 3 in some type of three-way deal, trade-down type of thing, where let's just say Paul George goes to the Nets. The Nets give 8 to the Sixers. The Nets get 3 in order to take the George salary. And then the Sixers are able to flip additional assets to go get Kevin Durant from Phoenix. I'm just spitballing here. Something like that, to me, makes sense for all three teams. Nets move up, Sixers get an upgrade, Suns get major salary relief and assets back. Like, it feels like a mutually beneficial deal for all three parties involved. And so if some of the stuff that isn't going to happen, like trading up to number 2, I doubt the Spurs are going to trade down from number 2. If that's not going to happen, if trading Paul George in a trade down to Utah isn't going to happen, are they just going to straight up trade down? Are they going to stay at 3 and take Knipple or Trey Johnson or VJ Edgecombe instead of Ace Bailey? Or maybe they actually go for an upgrade and still maintain some youth in the deal. I just have a feeling some crazy, unexpected thing could happen when it comes to Kevin Durant and where his next team is. Rather than all of these teams everybody's talking about, it could be just somebody out of nowhere where you get the Shams report breaking, Philadelphia 76ers, Charlotte Hornets, whoever it is, Golden State Warriors closing in on deal for Kevin Durant. And then 5 minutes later, it officially happens. Like, that's just my gut feeling with how this is going to go. And that's why I'm thinking about some of these outside the box ideas. What do you think, Tom? Is that your prediction for KD?
I suspect he goes to Houston. I think a lot of what you're hearing from Houston's side is posturing, trying to get his asking price down so they can take a couple assets off the table with Phoenix and say, hey, Phoenix, you have no leverage here. You've already announced that you're trying to trade this guy and you don't want him for next season. So we know that you're cornered and everybody else knows that you're cornered. So whatever asking price you have, you don't want to have to go into this offseason with this hanging over you and financially and the CBA and all that. So I suspect that Houston is just sitting there quietly being like, I know that you're going to be coming back to us at the 11th hour when the last call is at the bar. You're going to be finding us to go home with us at the end of the night. We know that you're flirting with other people. You're coming back home with us. So I suspect that that's what's happening here. Look, man, like for Brooklyn, like the Paul George thing is interesting for Brooklyn because like the salary floor rules that we have in the league, like who's Brooklyn going to pay over the next 5 years? You know, like who is their
centerpiece? I heard they're not a Kuminga team. I heard they don't really care for Kuminga. So right, like they're a team that would pay Kuminga. But exactly. So Paul George is a salary that can be helpful. And what if George has a good year? You could flip George. He could restore his value. And then you flip them in February. That could be a smart route for the Nets, in my opinion. It's kind of a buy low, and you could be helped out with a higher pick or some other assets in order to do it. I don't know. I just think something could be up there. Something could be up with Paul George and the Nets.
Yeah, well, also OKC did this a lot, is hoarding cap space and taking first-round picks from teams and be like, hey, Al Horford, Kemba Walker, who? Come on down. I will take whoever it is, whatever bad contract you want, and then I will take your first-round picks and go get a Chet Holmgren and Jalen Williams, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, down the line. So
and look remember, at him now. Game 7 Sunday.
Brooklyn Nets winning the NBA Finals potentially in 2032.
Taking on the Paul George contract. Paul George is the reason why the Pacers and the Thunder are here.
Brooklyn, make it happen. Why haven't you already done this deal?
What are you waiting for, Brooklyn? Come on, take on Paul George. Tom, we got game 7 on Sunday. I can't wait. It's been fun, man. Been a fun series. Appreciate you joining me tonight, dude. Thank you, Tom.
Yeah, can't wait, man. Thanks so much. And I can't wait for Sunday, dude.
Thank you, everybody, in the YouTube, X, Facebook, and TikTok chats for watching us live. If you didn't catch the whole podcast, you'll be able to catch the whole thing on the Kevin O'Connor Show as soon as it publishes. Hope you have a great weekend. We'll be back again on Sunday night with another live stream. I also got a podcast guest as well talking NBA draft. We're recording that on Sunday afternoon. Look forward to talking draft, talking finals, talking offseason, everything going on around the NBA. Catch that on the Kevin O'Connor Show on Sunday. Thanks to the whole crew for staying up late on this Thursday night producing this live show. Have a good weekend. Talk soon.